What can be both a blessing and a curse are the startups in this space. That you can look at a startup and say, hey, they're actually trying to revolutionize something, they're trying to disrupt, and all the associated buzzwords with startups, but they are trying to do something different with this technology, and that's where it gets very interesting. Unfortunately, along with those that are doing a real difference, you'll get those that are kind of saying they want to make a difference and just not really using the technology in a way that is necessarily disruptive, and it's just actually to benefit themselves. So it's been a bit of a minefield over the years, but seeing what people are doing and reading a lot of is probably the best advice I can give.
That is James Zaki, and this is episode 15 of the Blockchain Pro Podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the Blockchain Pro Podcast. I'm Adriana Bellotti, and today's guest is James Zaki. James has had an interesting work life with experiences ranging from industrial and home automation to tech companies and startups. He's passionate about IoT and blockchain and is a keen organizer and mentor at our local meetups. Let's dive right into it. All right. Hi, James.
Hello.
How's it going?
Very good.
Thanks for being here today in this very hot summer Australian day.
I just rode on over, so get to break a little sweat.
That's a good thing to do, like at 1 p.m. in the afternoon when it's nearly 30 degrees outside.
That's it.
Keeps you fit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. let's go back to what inspired you to pursue a tech career and how you got started.
Yeah, so I've, I guess, been into tech since I was a kid. At around the age of, before 12, I guess, I was playing with Lego, but then I was really liking Technic Lego, the Lego that you can kind of configure and program little things with. Then around 12, I got into QBasic programming, or GW Basic book that I sort of taught myself with, and built up from there. Sort of, I just had an innate curiosity for this thing that was like a black box to me. And then from there, just kept going with it. I sometimes describe programming as being able to bang your head against a brick wall and then get through it. And that's sort of, I guess, I trained myself early on to get through that. So that's sort of where it began.
You have to have the skill of being wanting to pursue something endlessly until you figure it out.
Yeah, in the face of failure after failure after failure. So you get used to it pretty quick, trying lots of things and they're not working, and then when they do work, you're very rewarded. Like, you're just quite happy when things work.
I remember when I was at uni and I did like two programming classes, and I didn't really like it very much, but whenever I had an assignment, it was really hard, and I would always be programming like late at night, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
I would go to bed and then I would wake up with a solution to my problem.
Exactly. Yeah.
Such a good hack. So for the students out there, just go to sleep with the problem in your mind, and most likely you will wake up knowing what to do.
Exactly. We're talking with some colleagues today on that exact point, how your subconscious mind does all the smarts, or does a lot of the smarts in the background. So if you're able to read a problem first, absorb it, and then take a break, that can be helpful, because then your subconscious mind chews it up different ways.
Always there.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
Yeah,
anyway,
brain's amazing.
We digress.
Yeah.
So so how did you start your career? You did you do a uni degree or?
Yep. So I guess I started basically with the subjects leading up to university, where I just loaded them up to be very tech heavy. I had I did 4 unit math, 3 unit engineering science, 2 unit physics, 2 unit chemistry, which left very little room for humanities. But the obligatory ones were like 1 unit general studies and 2 unit general English. So I still remember that. I loaded myself up very tech heavy in those final years. Dropping French before that, which I was quite interested in at the time, but focus being on tech, and with a bit of push from dad, that was the focus there. Then, end of year 12, looking towards different degrees at different universities, between mechanical, mechatronics, or computer science, and what combinations of those existed. And Sydney Uni had a good one for me at the time, which was a combined degree in mechatronic engineering with computer science. So then I could do some electrical, some machines, and programming of those, and then also pure software development as well. and so I did that and graduated, 2003.
And so, how did you start your career after that?
Then I got into my, I guess I did work experience first, which was the 3 months before your final year of uni. So I did 3 months at, basically it was a company that was inside the Kellogg's factory down at Botany.
Okay.
And so it was in industrial automation. So the interesting part with that is that it takes like a raw product like corn at the top floor of the building. Then through each level, it just gets refined and processed until at the very end, you're left with pallets of cornflakes boxes leaving on trucks. It's incredible that the machine that goes there, just a whole lot of corn.
It smells so
top.
Nice.
It does, yeah. It smells quite nice. Unlike breweries, not as good, nor the sewage plant that I did briefly as well. my first job out of uni then was doing visual inspection systems on industrial production lines. So something like a bottle going past. They go past at quite a high frequency, and you don't want someone standing there checking the level of every bottle. So we set up a system with a light behind the bottle and a camera in the front, such that it will snap an image at each bottle. So you've got to have that timed and in sync. And then you have some very fast image processing. And in those days, the computers aren't as strong as they are today. So you've got to be really efficient with processing the image to guess the level of it, to see the alignment of the bottle top. And then once you know that it's a pass or a fail, like if it's overfilled or underfilled, it's considered a fail, you then trigger a mechanism to jet off that bottle off the line. So it's very interesting work in terms of sort of
what was the fail rate?
Not very much.
Okay, that's good.
There is an interesting story if you want to hear around the sort of the biscuit cheese snack packets, and we had a camera that was looking at those as well. And what would sometimes happen is that a biscuit would get crushed in the cheese. So the camera would detect these shadows and these darker colors inside the cheese and then blow it off the production line with a kind of pneumatic jet. Then when the product changed its cheese to be cheese and chives, you then had every packet just being blown off because it saw the shadows of the chives thinking it was broken biscuit. So, yeah, it's an early lesson in, like, you can tell a machine what to do, but it might not do what you think it should do.
Yeah. Yes, well, machines only do what they're programmed to, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So you're working with all these fabulous production line things, and how did you discover blockchain?
Yeah, I guess from I went more into app development first. So moving out of industrial automation into embedded systems and then some wearable ideas and then developing the firmware for those machines. After that, got into app development because at the time the first apps were quite resource constrained. So yeah, resource constrained device is something that you have to be quite considerate of memory. So that was my background before then. So getting into apps early days, that was valuable. And then as apps got more and more sophisticated, you had web developers able to write apps for iOS and Android quite easily without needing to consider those lower level things. And that was around the time I happened to have discovered, Ethereum at that point. So then I looked towards the technology in general, like blockchain technologies, decentralized technologies at that point, and saw, okay, this is something that is meaningful. It's something that could be quite transformative. So I then pursued it further.
And how was the journey?
I guess it was, everyone describes it as falling down the rabbit hole.
Yes.
So it was very much that, like I have to say when I first discovered it, it was via a colleague in 2014, and I unfortunately did nothing with that. He came in all excited about Bitcoin, saying, oh, there's this digital money called Bitcoin, there's going to be these ATMs that you can put in cash and get Bitcoin, and I took him as a bit of a crackpot at the time, but I guess I was the fool after that. So I did nothing with that at 2014. Early 2017, I had been encouraged to go to this talk, and it was Luke Anderson who was presenting. He's got a background in security, and he was talking about Ethereum, or I think specifically Ethereum, but maybe it was general blockchain as well. And I got the gist of it then, and I thought, this is kind of interesting, and I definitely wanted to know more. So I probed him a bit more and some others in the community reaching out. Then I discovered Bocky's workshops that he would meet up in the middle of the day talking about Ethereum. And I thought, okay, I can make time for this. And then quite quickly, I kind of realized this is something I want/need to do to be on the next thing. So it was a bit of deja vu for when I first got into iOS apps. And now that it's like it's the early days of blockchain technologies, it feels the same to me. This is like a just another wave that I'm at the beginning of, that I just know that I need to keep up to speed with quickly and make it do something.
And what tools or resources do you use that help you stay on top of these new developments?
Lots of reading. It's hard to list all the tools. I basically put a note to say lots of reading. So there's many different channels out there, and it's always changing, I think. There's some good Medium articles out there on practical topics. So there's that. There's certain repositories that talk about technical specifications, so that could be interesting as well. But what can be both a blessing and a curse are the startups in this space. That you can look at a startup and say, hey, they're actually trying to revolutionize something, they're trying to disrupt, and all the associated buzzwords with startups, but they are trying to do something different with this technology, and that's where it gets very interesting. Unfortunately, along with those that are doing a real difference, you'll get those that are kind of saying they want to make a difference and just not really using the technology in a way that is necessarily disruptive, and it's just actually to benefit themselves. So it's been a bit of a minefield over the years, but seeing what people are doing and reading a lot of is probably the best advice I can give.
Read fast and a lot.
That's it, yeah. Yeah. Join some Telegram groups on different topics and read those.
Yeah, join the conversation.
Yeah.
Right? Join the meetups.
Meetups, absolutely, yeah.
Code-togethers.
Yep. So doing some code-togethers.
What is your favorite thing about blockchain, if there's just one thing?
I think... Yeah, it's anticipating how it can change things in the future. Like it has, I believe it has a disruptive impact. Like there is potential for disruption in certain industries, but I guess we're not going to see it take full effect until maybe 5 to 10 years. But in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of things starting in that direction. Right now, we're sort of seeing existing solutions, like centralized solutions, existing on decentralized technologies. And that's, I believe, okay for now. And as long as they're looking towards transition towards decentralized models from early on, you're not going to get too stuck in business as usual, but you will be able to entertain this disruptive model of what might be decentralized governance.
Why do you think decentralization is so important?
I guess I wrote a Medium article, I think it's Blockchain in 300 Words, and in there I sort of describe I refer to when Bitcoin began. And it was interesting to look back at it. It was around the time of the GFC, when the banks were getting bailed out by taxpayer dollars for the risks that they took at the expense of consumers. So that made a solid case of saying, hey, this system that we rely on so heavily isn't necessarily all that good. And we've had results from the Royal Commission just come out in Australia, likewise sort of saying these big four aren't really doing things in our best interest all the time. Well, I presume most of the time, but maybe not. Maybe I'm being optimistic there. But there's a lot of foul play, if you will, that was discovered, and management knowing that that's happening. So it's a potential to get away from that dependency, but also a way of rethinking how organizations are structured. I've worked in a lot of different companies, and when freelancing, it's quite interesting to see the kind of flocking of people, of other freelancers, towards a project and then off to the next thing. And it's quite beautiful, because you're not obliged, like in a company, to be working alongside someone, but in a way you're choosing to work together on that project. And it might be just a short project, but everyone has a journey. Like everyone's come from another project and everyone's going to another one after that. And it's just quite beautiful that for that moment you can work together and achieve something that's quite, like in this industry, it was quite a spectacular thing. And then after that you go your own way and know that in the future you may work together again, but there's no structure to it. But I can understand that there'll be some listeners out there who might think, well, that's too structureless. But I think once you get a taste of freedom and knowing that you have some skills that you can share with others and you can work with other people and they can work with you, then it, the world's your oyster after that.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
How do you explain blockchain for your non-tech friends?
Yeah, I have looked at a few of the blockchain, the flow diagrams, and there can be some complex ones out there saying when do you do or don't need a blockchain. And I did kind of summarize this much simpler graph, but it sort of comes down to multiple people who don't trust each other, who want to write to a common data store without a trusted third party. It was basically this flow diagram with four questions in it, and only if you answered the four a certain way, then you'd need a blockchain. Any other scenario, you don't necessarily need one. So if you have a few people that need to write some data down and they don't trust each other, but they have a trusted third party, you don't need a blockchain. So that's sort of more in the use case of it. To explain it in, the lower level in a non-technical way, the ledger is kind of the term people understand, that it's a log of transactions, and those transactions are incentivized to be kept consistent between everyone. And then you can start to break it down into the mechanics of it, which is also quite interesting in this space.
It is true. Those types of conversations are the ones that I love having.
Exactly.
In your opinion, what are the best and worst things in this industry?
The best is the community of developers, who are building those decentralized things that I was talking about. But I would say now it's the early days. It's people are building the tools that can be put together in the future to build these interesting structures. I'm not even going to necessarily call them businesses. I'm more tempted to say communities, where people will be having tools that they can use to work with each other in a trustless peer-to-peer way. So the developers today, that community is quite good in the industry. But as for the worst, it would be the scammers. Mm-hmm. And everybody probably has their story of almost getting scammed or actually getting scammed. And the people out there who, whether by intent or negligence, are just thinking they can achieve so much, or at least telling people they're going to make so much or achieve so much. But really, they're just there to get some free either... Yeah, a quick buck, basically. So watching out for scammers is probably the something I learned only in this industry. In the past, I could do an app dev contract, a wearable tech or embedded systems contract without a formal written arrangement. I should say everyone should have a written agreement. But to this day, until I got into blockchain, I have used them for the various contracts. But if it was just someone I could talk to and they say I wanted this done and I could do it, it would just work via email confirmation of rates and whatnot. That was plenty to go ahead, deliver, and everybody was happy in the end every time. I got into this space, presumed the same thing, made that mistake, and had to, with a particular scammer, had to find a way to put pressure on them, say, to pay back their dues to myself and others. And many others they owe much more money to. So, yeah, the scammers are out there, and hopefully that's since subsided, since the price has gone down, but we'll see.
There's always going to be scammers. There's always going to be Ponzi schemes.
Exactly. Scammers going to scam.
Exactly. That's not just a blockchain thing. It's a human thing.
Some people
want to take advantage of others.
That's it. I might have just been lucky in the tech space before that, where we're all quite doughy-eyed and innocent. But, yeah. You learn and then you keep it in mind for next time.
Yeah, I guess it's also because blockchain and crypto, or free money.
Yeah, exactly.
Work hand in hand.
Yeah.
And are very closely related. And then people that wanted a big piece of that free money pie,
that's it,
had that mindset.
Yeah, the expression I learned in this space as well was a honeypot. Like, I hadn't heard that referred to in this sense, but it makes perfect sense that there's this almost potential for free money, that people are saying, oh, I can make this much money if I promise this much thing, and that you put that token on an exchange and then the price goes up, then you sell. It's just a honeypot for those who see that happening.
Very irresistible.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing that I had not planned to talk about, but maybe we could just briefly delve into it, is the mingling of IoT and blockchain.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's plenty of... I remember back in 2014, or maybe 15, Andreas did a talk that he said something about automated payments that could,
right,
cars or something like that,
yeah,
that could automatically be paid through,
absolutely,
a blockchain or something like that. Could you have
thought about this? Yeah, I think I've seen that talk. But it's an interesting point. Like, so I wear sort of two hats. Like I run some IoT meetups as well as some blockchain workshops in different capacities. And yeah, I'm always looking at that to where you can bring the, sort of the truth of reality that is something you can measure with a device to be something worthwhile and tangible to use in a blockchain transaction. The example I often give in this supply chain case is with fish. And in the transportation of fish, you've got a quality measure. And if it's detected that, say, the temperature of the fish went above a certain threshold, then the quality or like some percentage indicator says that the person buying it can anticipate a lower yield, so therefore has to pay less. So there's got to be tracking, and these things happen. But the way they happen, it's one of those examples of you've got multiple people needing to write data along the same transport, like a fish along the supply chain. So all of those people, if they don't have a trusted third party, they will need to then use something like a blockchain technology. So the hard part is if you've got someone at the moment, sorry, in the moment of measurement, writing down a fake sensor reading, then that's not so great because then you've kind of lost the trust at the point of entry. But pushing it further back into a device could make that a little easier. So if you're able to have a reading and then have it cryptographically signed and then put onto the blockchain, then you've got something that at least the sensor has reported. If they've gone and put the sensor in a cold bucket of ice versus the fish, well, again, you can't really stop that, mm-hmm. but you can push it out as far as you can and have, like in other industrial systems, you have maintenance checks and things like that. So you can always have audits and checkups.
And cameras, well. Making sure that, you know, it's not the person putting the sensor on the ice bucket.
Exactly. But then you could get something like people faking images of them reading the sensor.
Yes.
But it's always that next level. As long as, I think this is the way these things work, is as long as it's more complex to fake the system than it is to just the cost of actually reporting it honestly, then people probably won't bother. That's the ideal. If they've really stuffed up a batch of fish, then I'm sure they're going to go to great lengths to fake the sensors. But yeah, I think there's some interesting stuff there. And when you get to those examples of, I think Andreas Antonopoulos was talking about driverless cars that maintain themselves. It was a very interesting talk. He's a great communicator. I love his work. The other examples around decentralized ownership is when they refer to Uber and saying, the decentralized Uber, where Uber takes 30%, but if you had machines running the network themselves, running their own cars, paying for their own petrol, paying for their own maintenance, and to do that, they probably need sensors and ways of reporting things of the actual car, then you can optimize something to be more efficient than Uber. But that's still probably a little while away, and a lot of interesting tech to get there.
It's the merge of the Internet of Things with the Internet of Money.
Exactly, yes.
Quite interesting times.
Yeah, can't wait to see what it will become.
Me neither. So, okay, tips for noobs.
Tips for noobs, I would say read. Lots of reading. And find people in your community. Like we said before, the meetups. You just want to find people who are aligned, who are willing to learn, who want to learn, who are keen to share their learnings. And fortunately, in the open source space, you find a lot of those. There will always be, you know, companies with protected interests building proprietary things that they can't share, but still people from those companies can come out and share certain things and give talks. So there's a lot of people out there in various capacities who can share content, and wherever you can meet people face-to-face and have those chats, it's, that's really good.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful community.
Yeah, I think we're lucky here.
We are. I'm around the world. I've been to meetups in different cities, in different countries, and, you know, community is always the best part of it.
It's almost like a small global family, in a way. It gets that way when it's a new thing. There are some people in South Africa who are organizing a Ethereum organizers group, and through them, I've just moderated one of their calls. I've sat in on another call, and we're planning the next call. It's just another group of people who are very nice and very keen to develop community engagement and to do more with communities. Other groups around, like at the Web3 Summit, there was the education ring, and from that there was a developer education ring, and then a group of us formed around that. and we started pulling together resources of educational resources as well. So there's a lot of work to be done, but still a lot of people out there willing to help out.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Any final words of wisdom?
I think that's about it. I mean, I was going to say learn coding, but that's you know, that's what I'll say to everything. But always take a look under the hood. Like wherever there's some application or something you're using or a tool you're using, it doesn't hurt to look that next layer or two deep to understand the mechanisms behind it. It will both, enrich what you can do with those things, but then also prevent you from misunderstanding and being misled. But yeah, always look the next layer deep.
And contribute to open source.
Exactly.
Open source is the awesome source.
Awesome, thank you.
Thank you, James.
My pleasure.
And that was James Zaki. You can get in touch with James on Twitter at James_Zaki, at JAMES_ZAKI. As usual, you can also get in touch with me. I'm A Bellotti, ABELOTTI. And I hope you enjoyed this episode. This was a bit of a different experience for me because I interviewed James, mixed and released this episode all on the same day. I'm trying to get a bit better at this so I can produce more content for you. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. And if you have a couple of minutes, write a review. That always makes my day. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you at the next block.